So the goal today is not on the basic systems, just the Fermi surface, show why that's different. And I had started to set that up by looking at a scalar, not on the basic scalar. And the idea was to motivate. Bottom line of this first part is just that the thing you're starting off with is essentially a Schrodinger kind of restriction. Just once your energy is below the mass of the particle, then the thing that you're effectively, the thing to do is to integrate out the antiparticle, and then what's left will just be an ordinary Schrodinger second quantized field theory. And this was to show you kind of how that would emerge in a cartoon kind of a way. So remember, we start off with a charged scalar, and I wanted it to be charged because I didn't want to have normally if it's big and heavy, there has to be a reason why it doesn't decay or doesn't annihilate. And charge won't save you from annihilation, but it can save you from decay. So the ground thing we were talking about was I was actually putting a metric in because I wanted to follow one particular thing later on. But the metric probably is less important. Since we're pressed for time, let's not worry about it. Following the metric was going to just show that if you follow the Newtonian potential, it just essentially couples to the mass of the particle. Okay? That's the right answer for gravity for slow things, because for slow things, most of the energy is in the rest mass, and so the rest mass should be within the dominates the couple of gravity. But so if you follow the metric in this and you follow where Newton's for the Newtonian potential, as you can see that the where I'm getting a mass is where you would have found I'll keep the metric and I won't make that last point, but where you get the mass is going to be a thing where it's where the Newtonian potential is. So we're interested in something like this. I can't remember if I called it phi or psi last time. Remember? Other than psi.
Phi.
Okay. So the and remember the problem was if you did a mode expansion and you start thinking in terms of you think of phi going like e to the I px, which is e to the minus I omega t plus I momentum dot x. The problem, we're thinking that derivatives are small, and so things that we're not writing here are powers of fields and powers of derivatives. But there's a dangerous thing about the derivatives being small if the mass is actually not small. Because this frequency that's occurring here is the square root of m squared plus p squared. So that's m plus p squared plus 2m, and so on. And this is not small. So the frequency is not, the time derivative is not actually varying slowly. So it was useful to extract that fast phase out of the field once and for all. And once we've done that, then everything else, all the other remaining derivatives are just going to be differentiating either the momentum or the kinetic or things that really are small, and then it'll make sense to organize things in terms of potential. So that motivated, the last thing I did last time was to take some normalization sometimes e to minus I, t, and make it called chi, that's the definition. And we'll write things in terms of chi, because chi is the thing for whom derivatives should all be measuring some, either the smallness of the momentum or the smallness of the energy, compared to whatever the big scale is the problem. So with that choice, that Lagrange becomes there's a minus g. And there's the mass term, that's another thing that might bother you. If we're interested in the mass being small, being large, then this looks like it's not a small term. And we can see what's going to happen now. So there's a look at things that are going like m squared. There's a 1 coming from this term. And then there's a piece that's going to come from this term because the time derivative phi, if I use this definition, is going to be f at t to the minus I m t times the time derivative of pi. The time derivative could also take this thing and give me minus I. So if I write the time derivative in this piece out, square it, there's a piece which has got an m squared in it, which will appear in a similar way to the, this term, but it's going to have a contraction of gtt in it. So here. And then the phases will cancel. And then there's going to be a next biggest things will be things linear in mass, which I can get when I take a cross term. And this thing squared is a cross term between those guys. So that'll give me a 9 over 2 with f squared. Pi is not real because phi is also not real. Because it was charged.
Yeah,
but if neither of them is real, it doesn't make a difference.
No, it's still charged.
Yeah, so this is just my definition of pi. Take it as a definition. F is a number which I'm going to choose to. In the same way that we chose the going for the kinetic term here, that we have a normalization minus 1, I'm going to do something over here, and I'll choose that. And one of the things I'm not being, I want to turn that game around here. M squared. So far, so good. So the cross term here, I'm going to get GT. Space, K, and other density, M. There'll be two terms depending on which side it could do. So we'll have then the next term will be squared. We got the spatial derivatives here. It will be g a l.
So I have like a term that has proportional to m, which has gtt, just from squaring the thing you have over there.
This thing squared again?
Yeah, the one is a dtk and the other one is a m, but then you have a gtt, not a gtk.
Which were, are you thinking of this one here?
Yeah. So
oh, these are all gtk, you're right. So this term came from the m squared, and the second term came from the cross term, and the third term came from this squared, and the last term came from the spatial derivative squared. And what's bothering me is factors of two.
I have 2 with more than it should be 2, and keep expanding.
That's probably what I've got wrong. The word that the thing is a 2, there's, I think there should be no 2 at all, right? So it should have been just, that's what it is, the 2 should be there. That's the spatial derivative here, so, so I'm thinking... Oh, yeah, sorry. So x mean is equal to g... Alright, so the thing is that what I'd like to do is I'd like to write this term here. This is the kinetic, this is the leading, the fewest derivative term, right? These have two derivatives. These has no derivatives. So I'll come back to those in a second. But the thing I'd like to normalize in this canonical way, like this thing, is the kinetic term. And so what I'm going to do is choose f to make this coefficient standard. And so I'm going to make it equal to, so I'm going to choose f squared times m to be a half. Because I've got two terms here, so if I kind of integrate with this, I might just factor two from those two terms. So that's going to tell me to choose x squared to be equal to 1 over 2m. Yeah. So that's a choice. And that will arrange that l becomes minus g. So that particular term becomes I over 2 dtt. I start dt times dt times times. And then now I just get what I get here. So this is now going to become, so if I have f squared, this is now m over 2. This term becomes minus 2m and the spatial term is so again, the choice of making the same standard is going to be because when we're deciding how important interactions are, and what do? We use dimensional analysis at some level. And the dimensional analysis involved knowing what the dimensions of the fields were. And we chose the dimensions of the field. The dimensions of the fields were basically fixed for us by the condition that we had no coefficients in front of the kinetic terms. So once we canonically normalize things, so this coefficient is 1, then in the relativistic problem, the condition of the Lagrangian had dimension of mass to the fourth, which is what the action had to be dimensionless, told us what the dimensions of the fields are. And so this is, we're building on the same, similar kind of requirement. But if we normalize the fields, this kinetic term is kind of a standard coefficient. And I'm choosing it to look like the Schrodinger, the time derivative part will look like the Schrodinger equation. And, that's going to fix what the dimension of these fields is. And it's going to be a little bit different than it was for the relativistic case because f is going to scale it in a particular way, is the main message. And so I'm not going to push this much farther here beyond saying that the, if we've been at flat space, you know, g, t, t, minus 1, g, k, l, g, delta, k, l. And so this would actually die in flat space. So this looks like it's undergrowing M, and what it's really telling you is that if we had had if it had GTT in minus 1 plus some Newtonian potential, 2 pi, then GTT would become minus 2 pi. And this is going to turn into minus 2 times capital pi. So it's giving you the coupling of Newtonian gravity to the mass, which is what you expect to be there. But if we weren't following gravity, then this would have just died because of this projection. The GTT plus 1 is 0 in flat space. And then the dominant time derivative is this one. And the first space derivative, so this is something we can drop as being subdominant in time derivatives compared to this one, suppressed by the mass. But the dominant space derivative is this one, which is the same suppression. That's the thing that is describing. That's the thing that's describing the momentum dependence of the energy in the Schrodinger equation. So if I keep this right there, this is the thing that if I had just had these two terms, they, and I solved the equations of motion, I would have been solving, you know, I times dt chi star e chi would be equal to minus L squared 2m chi, which is the free Schrodinger equation. And so the mode functions there would have energies which were e squared over 2m. Is what you get from this. Better if I asked for plane wave solutions. And so if I'm interested in how things propagate, the message there is going to be that you might have thought, well, why do you keep any, why, if you throw this term away, why do you throw this term away? And the message here is that in a non-holistic system, we should be thinking of the low energy limit a little bit more carefully than we were before. In a relativistic system, time and space were the same, basically, and so when we went to the low energies, we could scale all the coordinates, all the energy and momentum both to zero together. And in that case, it wasn't really important to follow whether momentum and energy were scaling differently. Or the low energy limit, if the energy was of the order, for relativistic systems where the energy is of the order of the momentum, low energy and low momentum are the same thing. For non-relativistic systems where we're asking for the energy for the particles we're following to be scaling at the square of the momentum, then we should be thinking about the low energy limit. We should be thinking of the momentum and the energy scaling differently in the low energy limit, because the particles we're trying to follow at low energies, it relates energy to momentum in a way which is scaling different. So we should be expecting that the low energy limit should be described by, as the energy scales to zero, momentum scales to zero, like the square root. If the momentum goes to zero like lambda, then the energy should go to zero like lambda squared because of this dispersion question. And so if we scale energy and momentum in that way, that's telling us in this Lagrangian how that spatial derivatives and time derivatives are not equal size. And so in that scaling, two space derivatives is like one time derivative, so that's why this and this we can take it independent of each other as the unperturbed Lagrangian in the path integral. Whereas something like this is more suppressed than the low energy limit because it scales like more time derivatives. So two space derivatives is kind of like one time derivative. I think the four space derivatives would have like two time derivatives that would be competitive with this one, and so on. So you could try and formulate more systematically the rules, but the thing you should be giving up in a non-relativistic system is that the energy and momentum are scaled in the same way. So I want to make that a little bit more formal, because it's also true that in non-relativistic applications, you're often not in a regime where you believe translation invariance, or it needn't be true. Here I assume that the energy for small energy meant small momentum, and for free particles that's true. But in the applications to where I'd like to go now is we have to choose what systems we're describing. And if the system we're describing is free particles that are not degenerate, then the kind of scaling I'm describing would be the way to identify the low energy limit. But where I'd like to head is towards the particles that are near a Fermi surface, so that their energy is actually not such a simple, you know, the energy would be some complicated functional momentum. And so, because I have in mind applications to condensed matter physics, what you know in condensed matter physics is that the energy, because the underlying nuclei in which in whose fields the electrons are moving is periodic, the energy typically lives in some sort of a, you know, Riemann zone. And it has the property that as you shift, there can be momenta which are not small, or about on the size whose wavelength corresponds to the interatomic spacings, for whom the energy is small. The energy can be something like sine of momentum, so it starts off at zero, for 0 momentum, but then it goes back to 0 for something on 0 momentum, and then the momentum's not at all small. And so in the applications, so two things that are going to change in these condensed matter applications from what we've done before are, first, we're going to be thinking about scaling momentum and energy differently. And the way to decide how to scale them is to ask, in the situation of interest, the particles that are propagating, you know, what's the connection between energy and momentum that's relevant for the low-energy particles you're trying to capture? And that'll show you how to think how space and time should be scaled relative to one another. And near a Fermi surface, it's not going to be that the energy is proportional to the momentum. It'll be the energy will be linear momentum again. So that'll be a slightly different scaling influence over here. And the second thing to ask is for effective field theory, you're always thinking in terms of what the low energy states are. And we're used to thinking in a relativistic context that low energy and low momentum are the same thing. But in these applications, it may mean that high momenta are low energies, in which case we can't be doing the momentum expansion. We should be thinking of things as being functions of momentum that would be complicated functions, even though we're looking at low energies. And so in that kind of situation, it's not necessarily useful to be working in position space. I mean, what's nice about the effective action relativistically is that it was local in space and time. It was local in time because of the certainty principle that because you just restrict the low energies, when you remove something that was heavy, you can only violate energy conservation and produce it over a small time scale. So that's why you always have things that are local in time. The locality in space was to do with a similar argument that if you were somehow removing large momenta because they were also large energies, then momentum conservation would have said that you have to do that locally in space. But if you're not removing large momenta because large momenta could have low energies, then there's nothing saying that that what you're looking at is going to look like it's local in position space. So there's no advantage in these systems for which large momenta can have low energies to be thinking in position space rather than momentum space, because the advantage that we would normally have been there, which is locality, is not there anymore. And so so it's actually convenient to work in local in time, but non-local in momentum space in that case, just because in momentum space you've at least itemized and part of your project. So those are the two changes that I'm going to do when I look at this degenerate systems. One of them will be scaling momentum differently than energy, based on that kind of motivation. And the second one will be, I'm not going to worry about being in position space because I'm going to be imagining that the energy is small whenever you're near the Fermi surface, but the Fermi surface will be including momenta, which are not necessarily small. Okay, so that's I'm kind of doing that because that's the last topic because I wanted to do the effective field theory. And this was more or less motivation for these two changes. So far, this discussion was all bosons. But if you did the same thing for a Dirac fermion, let's say, then the analog of this expansion like this is what in the old days was called a Foley-Wolfhausen. Transformation. If you look in Bjork and Drell, the old textbook from the 60s, on relativistic quantum mechanics, it typically comes up when you're trying to look at relativistic corrections to atoms. So you're in a regime where you're not in the deep relativistic limit, you're in just a little bit relativistic limit. And so it's a choice of basis for the Dirac spinners for which the momentum expansion, the powers of 1 over m are kind of controlling everything here, powers of the velocity. And so it comes up, and for the same reasons in this kind of a field theory description of spin a half particles. And it's essentially the same reason. You're trying to remove this large scale. You want to make sure that the large scale is always appearing inversely in your interaction as opposed to the big positive power that you would have had otherwise coming from the master. All right, so the idea now will be that, so we've got some in momentum space. There's some surface. It shouldn't have to be round or anything. For which we can think of the, so we'll think that there's that we have a bunch of interacting fermions. They're not interacting so strongly that the single particle approximation is that, just our operative. And the goal will be, so where this will go is I want to set up how you would, keeping in mind that momentum and energy are scaling differently at low energy limit. I'd like to ask, how do different kinds of interactions scale at low energies? And if we kind of went past the free particle and looked at the interactions, what can you say about how those interactions scale? And the message will be given that you to do that, I'm going to need to know where to start, and I'm going to be implicitly thinking that there's some zeroth order Lagrangian that's weakly interacting, and I'm imagining describing this everything perturbatively, so that we're identifying how things scale, more or less classically, so we're not going to acknowledge the magnitude. And so in that perturbative approach, so the assumption is that there's some range of energies for which the degrees of freedom that you're trying to follow are weakly interacting. And then the conclusion will be that if you ever enter that region, we'll also assume that they kind of have the quantum numbers of electrons. So it's they don't have to be electrons, but they'll have electric charge of electrons that will be spin and half particles. And so they could be some sort of dressed electron, but there's a quasi-particle assumption is it has the properties of electrons. When it's weakly interacting, then what we'll show is that the interactions generically all with one interesting exception, get less and less important at lower and lower energies. So that once you enter a range of energies where you have something that begins relatively interacting for which these arguments are unfortunately to apply, it just gets better and better and better as you go to lower energies. And that's ultimately the justification for the Landau theory or the free electron model of conductors. It's that once you get into a regime where they're not interacting much, at lower and lower energies, they interact less and less and less. And the important role of that will be played by the Fermi surface, which is if these things are not interacting, then because of the Pauli exclusion principle, you have to fill states up to some minimum size. And that's the surface I would draw here. So this is the Fermi surface as a function of momentum. That's the ground state. And what's making these interactions physically less important at low energies is that if you don't have a lot of energy, then if you start off with a state which is just above that ground state, and you're trying to scatter, you're not allowed to scatter into the states that are below here because those are already occupied. And so there's the statistics, the Pauli blocking, or the fact that you can't scatter into a state which is already occupied, is the thing that's suppressing interactions that would otherwise have been important. And so this counting rules for how interactions work will systematize how, so less and less energy you have, the more and more that's a debilitating problem that you can't scatter into states that are occupied, because you have less and less reach into the states that are not occupied as your energy, the excessive energy goes down. And the point of this exercise will be to quantify that. And so you'll see that as you get closer and closer to Fermi surface, the interactions are less and less important. And that's at some level why otherwise strong, what you would have thought to be strongly interacting systems like electrons and solids or nucleons and nuclei, that sounds like something for which perturbation theory should not be working very well. It works better than you think because of this Pauli blocking argument. I said there was an interesting exception to that, to the interaction becoming less and less important. You'll see that once we systematize it, that there's a class of interactions for which the strength of the interaction doesn't change as you get to lower and lower energies, so those are what you would call marginal interactions. It doesn't change at a classical level. You just scale it using dimensional analysis the way that I have been done until this point. So what you have to then do is you have to then be a little more careful and ask if I perturbatively ask how things scale, there'll be a radiative correction that will change slightly what all the scaling behavior of all these operators is. And that's, in general, a small correction, except for the case when, at the Costco level, there was no scaling at all. In that case, the leading statement is whatever the perturbation theory tells you. And the short version of the story will be that if there are interactions amongst these electrons which are attractive, then make these interactions that didn't change. There's two kinds of interactions. If there's an interaction directly amongst the electrons, there will be a class of interactions directly amongst electrons which doesn't change as you go to lower energies. The strength doesn't change as you go to lower energies. There's relative strength compared to the energy. But if you have another interaction apart from that, which is attractive, which through a loop is contributing to how that energy scales, an attractive interaction will make that interaction actually more and more important rather than less important, although only logarithmically so. And a repulsive interaction will make it less and less important rather than not changing at low energies, only logarithmically so. And so that's why in a superconductor, a very feeble interaction like the phonon, in a superconductor, there's a pairing that goes on because you have a lattice of ions. You stick an electron somewhere, and it kind of distorts the electrostatic attraction, slightly distorts the underlying lattice a little bit by pulling the charges towards it. And that small enhancement of the positive charge density can attract another electron towards it because there's a slightly more positive charge than there was before. And at face value, you would have thought that's something which can't be very important because it should be swamped by the direct Coulomb repulsion of the two electrons. And what this argument is showing you is that that direct repulsion is something which is actually being suppressed by this power blocking. And the feeble, even though it's feeble, this feeble attractive force can be the thing that amplifies this one marginal kind of interaction and make it important eventually at low energies. And that's when it becomes dominant, then that's when something interesting happens. That's what people care for, is that binds these two electrons together. But the justification for keeping that feeble attractive force and ignoring all these other stronger forces is precisely this scaling of how things go to low energy. So it's cool.
Cliff, when you say loop effects, do you mean loop effects, or?
I mean, for sure. So what we're always doing is we're managing, we're taking this action with all the dot-by-dot terms I'm not running down, and we're sticking in a path interval somehow, and we're doing a Gaussian thing at the end of the day where we say there's an unperturbed part, and then everything else we do a chain attached to it, just like we're doing basically.
Okay.
And so literally it's the perturbative correction is kind of the most things that work.
Okay.
Which you can count that graphically. We find the rule a little bit different now because the free part is different.
Right.
But if you track through what the differences are, that would just be perturbation theory the way it comes out of it. Okay, so what I'd like to get to is that scaling argument. So what I want to do is I'll start off with writing down the Lagrangian, and I'm going to write down something like this, but I'll just write down all possible things. And the important change will be that I won't do a derivative expansion anymore in the spatial derivatives. I'm going to just suppose that there's a momentum dependence, and the zeroth order Hamiltonian will have something which involves a single time derivative, as some function of momentum, which is describing whatever the analog of this function was for the system of interest, to be some complicated function, potentially the E is a function. So let me make that what that looks like. So if small energy large P well as small p. So for example, in one dimension, you could have something like epsilon is sine p or something like that. That would be the kind of thing where you plotted the energy against p. It would start off small. It would start off small and linear for small p. Then it would turn around again and become small again for large p. And that's the kind of thing that could happen if you have a periodic lattice and your energy is, because of the periodicity, when you go far enough in the limit space, your periodicity in space is becoming periodicity, implies periodicity in the linear space. And so your energies can be periodic functions of momentum, and so there will be non-zero values of momentum, which will give you low energies, because they're just the translations of the low energy, the low momentum states, under the reciprocal lattice vectors. So there's a dual lattice. You have periodicity in the momentum space under the dual lattice, to the one you have in the position space.
I'm sorry, can you scaling up energy in the
so far, I haven't noted scale yet. But for arbitrary momenta, I have to tell you, to say something useful here, I have to say what the Fermi surface is. So what I'll do is I'm going to expand around the Fermi surface, and so we'll take can we do that right now? So we'll take the zero energy. So this is where we're kind of filling in. We're matching that we have at least a couple set of fermions that are degenerate to start off with. So there's some energy, which I'll call the piece of F. Okay. So it's a subsurface like this. And what I'll do is I'll in a momentum space, let me label momenta on the surface by the vectors k, and the momenta that are off the surface will just call it energy p. So I'll put this table. P is the momentum, and I'll reserve k to be things that are on the Fermi surface. So I take this. I have this dispersion relation, and so the set of k's for which this is equal to zero. Defined by P equals A that's a sloppy way to say it, but it's, you know what I mean, that there is a surface corresponding to we've got some non-zero macroscopic number of fermions, say electrons. We fill them the zero, we start with low energy, low momenta, or whatever low energy was, and we occupy all the states until we get to some, until we use all the electrons up or all the fermions up. And where we stopped will be a surface. And so if you told me the dispersion relation for the energy as a function of momentum of the particles that we were using, then the condition that P is equal to Fermi energy, which would be basically the energy that I would have if I added up all the energies from the one I started off with to the last one I put in, it'll be some function of the number of particles. Then the set of P for which this is equal, these things are equal to one another will be defined on k. But what I'll do, what I'm going to do is I'm going to just choose my origin of energy to make this zero.
I do you mean here that the EF is the total energy of all those electrons, or is that the energy of an electron which happens to be at this P?
What I mean is the last one. The way you normally see this term as an abstraction, you take E of P. So if E of P were P squared of 2m, then surfaces of fixed P are spheres, and you would say that there was you would add things starting at P equals 0, you'd occupy states until you got to the last particle you stuck in, and the last particle coming in with energy for example, who's losing momentum, could it be smaller than the value of the, you know, the last thing that was occupied? And so then the Fermi surface I would gain then would be the single part that would be corresponding to that moment. In that case, the only restriction is on the magnitude of momentum because the whole thing is very asymmetric. And more generally, it could be some funny shape where there's some last energy, which is the lowest energy available for the last electron to get in. And so the ignoring what set that momentum, in this case, is what you call the Fermi momentum, and that's set by the density of electron, because you ask that if you integrate, I take the number of electrons per unit volume times, that should be the integral. I'm going to get that wrong, Isaiah. I can count the electrons. If I just integrate from p equals 0 to p Fermi times the density of states of electrons, which is the thing on the top of the head when I get it wrong, that has to be the total number of electrons we have. The density of states. If you make the momentum discrete, the way to do that is split pulses with the box. The density of states will be proportional to 1 over the volume, and so what you'll find is that the momentum that you get here will be some function of the density of the number of electrons per unit volume. So I just want to, if you want, you think of the sphere here, but think of k being momentum equals the Fermi momentum. And which is the thing that is zero energy to be whatever that surface was. So if there remain, because this is, I don't know if I'm meeting you, but it's something you already happy with, or if it's okay. All right, so that's the picture. And what we want to do is we want to write some effective Lagrangian for this thing. And we want to start it off with a kinetic term. So we'll have an alignment, and we'll have an I, psi, I2, right? Star dt star dt star star. And we want to have this dispersion relation, so we'll have to have a piece which is minus one e to the integrals here, because it's not position space. So this thing is going to be the reaction will be an integral over time. So this is now the unperturbed action, integral d3p. Of over 2 psi p psi star psi psi p psi, where psi is a function of momentum. And I'm doing that because I didn't want to do derivative expansion because I don't know that small momenta are required. And in particular, we're interested in things, not arbitrary energies. We're interested in energies that are very close to the surface. So it's going to be worthwhile to Taylor expand those energies around that surface. So what we'll do is we'll write E of P to be approximately equal to, so we'll write P is equal to something on the surface plus something off the surface, which I'll call L. And so that would be, so that when we're on the surface, and I'm using conventions where that energy is zero, so the first term will be, the first term in a Taylor expansion will be L dot, the derivative of the energy with respect to P, evaluated at K. Higher order terms. And so this gradient with respect to P of the energy is often called the Fermi velocity. So in terms of that, we take the energy and we think of it as being approximately L dot Fermi velocity. So that makes it effectively a linear function of the momentum that we have available to ourselves off the Fermi surface. And this is something that you can do. So in terms of this picture, the Fermi velocity would be some, we're taking in the normal direction to the Fermi surface everywhere. is it? Because it's a gradient, it's just another Riemann normal. But it's some function of the where you are on the surface. It's a function of k is only not of the direction of the surface. So what this is doing is it's making explicit the dependence and the momentum that are off the surface. So L is this is something which only sees zero if L is perpendicular to B. So any L lying on the primary surface would be zero, and all you'll see is the normal component of L off the surface. So it's useful to write, L on a basis where it's locally it's things that are in the k direction, so it's a hunt. So L parallel to the surface, and then there'd be one component normal to the surface. And this is saying we're looking at an entity which is linear in there. Okay. So now I want to make, so here's where I'm making a commitment to how things depend on momentum. And so, and then the story up until now has been, so for relativistic systems, what I want to ask now is how do we organize the expansion of the Lagrangian in terms of 1 over some heavy scale? Up until now, that's been more or less obvious because we've been doing everything for weak coupling in a relativistic system where energy and momentum are all the same. So what I should do now is be a little bit more formal about how that argument went. So I'm not going to, my goal is to write down a bunch of interactions and ask, are they suppressed by energy? And until now, what we've been doing is just use dimensional analysis. And what's happening in a non-relativistic case is that it's a little bit more complicated because we would have had to keep track of the momenta, spatial derivatives, and time derivatives differently. But now it's going to be even more difficult because you can see that some momenta don't cost any energy at all, and some momenta do. So we need to scale differently the energies off the Fermi surface from the ones on the Fermi surface. So to follow that, I want to make the argument a little more formally than before. And so what were we doing in principle when we're making these effective actions? What we're doing is we're integrating out. And we have some integral over momenta, and there's limits on the integrals. And what we were doing was we were coarse grinding by saying we'll get the highest energies, and we were removing the highest frequencies and the highest any states that were at high energies. We were slowly changing the Lewis integration to remove them and put them their effects into the interaction terms. And so, if you imagine changing the cutoff in momentum space from it's called lambda p, and there's some cutoff in energy, which in time is going to be a cutoff to small times. So we'll be cut off here at formally, what we were doing before was we were asking if we take lambda t and we change it, and we take lambda p and change it, we'd be asking how do various interactions scale with lambda if we do that. And the simplest way to systematize it in a more complicated system like this will be what we should do is we should think of rescaling these coordinates so that we have the same limits as before, and we'll ask when we do this rescaling of coordinates how that shows up in the interactions. And so derivatives and the measure will scale in a particular way. And what we'll do is we'll compensate for that scaling in the kinetic term by having the field scale in some prescribed way so that the kinetic term doesn't change at all. And that would be the analog of saying what the dimension of the field was in the relativistic case. But once we've done that for the kinetic term, we can go to all the other terms and ask, so what do we have to do now to make, how do they scale under this rescaling? And the ones that scale, as we bring this cutoff down to zero, the ones that are getting smaller in that limit are the ones that are becoming less important, the ones that are getting larger in that limit, the ones that are getting more important, the low energy regime. So what we'll do is, we'll rescale P to, well, I'm doing T. I mean, there's the same conventions as the other. what I'll do is I'll take, so as I, as, what I want to do is I want to take these cutoffs, I want to take lambda t, goes to s lambda t, so that's the way I'm going to, and s will go to 0 eventually, so we're going to make the lambda is like energy, so we're going to go into energies. And so at the same time, so now I have to decide how the lambda p scales. And so the what I would have done, so if we had had the energy was p squared over 2m, what I would have been doing here is I would have chosen lambda p to go to s to the 1/2 lambda p, and that would be scaling in such a way that that scaling will arrange for this term and this term, if this is a b squared of 2m, to scale the same. There'll be choice for how a psi will scale to make these terms scale the same way. So that'll be important if they're lower energies. But in this case, I have to do it a little differently because I have to, what I should do is I should ask L to scale, but k shouldn't scale at all because there's no, as I go to low energies, there's no energy cost at all for moving around on the frame surface. It's just the scaling of L that will make a difference. So unlike in the non-degenerate, non-realistic case where the energy and momentum are one's quadratic and the energy is quadratic momentum. Here we've got something which is linear in a component of momentum, but not independent essentially of the other components of momentum. So if we had had p was p squared over 2m, we would ask that lambda p goes to s to the 1/2 lambda p in order to not make this scale differently than this. The particles are going to follow. But in our case, we have E is equal to L times the frame velocity is function K. So we have to ask, in this case, that lambda L goes to S lambda L, just like it's the same as the energy, but lambda K doesn't change. So there's no part of S there at all. So we're not going to change, we're not going to remove any of the K integral, we're just going to integrate. The low energy limit in this case is we're looking at a range of energies near the Fermi surface, and we're making that range smaller. So the only thing that's changing is the distance from the surface, not where we are on the surface. So that's important because what we'll do is, rather than changing the limits of integration, instead what we'll do is we'll take t will go to 1 over s times t, and we'll take L goes to S times L, and K goes to K. And with that change, then the limits of integration don't change. So instead, change to this, so that lambda P and lambda L don't change. I should say also that, you know, so if we had had the energy was of the order of p, then we would have lambda p was s lambda p. And the rules I'm giving you now, if we'd done it for this case, would have given me exactly the same count of energies that we had in a relativistic case. And so I'm just being more pedantic about it because it's a more complicated case because of the momentum for different things. So I'm not telling you anything different than I just told you before. I'm just telling you in a way which is easier to apply to this case. So let's ask, how does this interaction, this free action scale under that choice? So if we're taking t goes to 1 over st, and l goes to s times l, and k doesn't change, the question is how must psi change? So we'll say s to the p times psi. So maybe that's not invariant. And this is the analog of asking how would I canonically normalize my fields? What would be the dimension of my fields if I canonically normalize them? If I asked this question for this choice, I would find what the dimensions of the field would be where you did before. All right, so we just take this action. And so what S naught was the integral of dt, dl, dq, k, basically the psi star, dt psi, and I won't write the other things, they're just kind of derivatives, and there's there's an epsilon, there's an L times V times K. So the scaling is that this goes like 1 over S, this goes like S, this doesn't do anything, so it's S to the 0. This gives me S to the P, this gives me S because dt is like 1 over dt, and this goes like S to the P, and this gives me S for the L, this gives me S to the 0, because it's dependent on K, and this gives me S to the P and S to the P. So you see that having these two terms scale the same way is working because this S and this S are the same. And that was the choice we made here. The reason we made this choice that they both scale the same way was because we wanted these things to scale the same way. So we've got the same power pairing both terms. If we didn't have to have p squared here, then this choice would have been the thing that would make them scale the same way. So that's kind of why that choice is made. We don't want low energy to have momentum dependence become irrelevant, because that's not the direction we're trying to follow. We're trying to follow momentum and energies, which are in the range, so it's that you're just near the parent surface, but otherwise the momentum are occurring. So that means that this whole thing is going like s to the... There's a minus 1, a plus 1 coming from the measure, and then this is giving us a plus 2p plus 1 coming from these terms. And so you can see that that's going like s to the 2p plus 1. So what we need to do is choose p equals minus 1 half in order to have this not scale at all. So psi goes to s to the minus 1 half psi. Keep this in. So why do you care? Now we look at interaction. What the interaction look like? Because what we like to do is take those interactions, and if you want to ask, how do they scale? Given that the free particle Lagrangian doesn't scale, the interactions will do something. So a two-body interaction. Is something of the form. It's a form where two particles have some momenta, something happens when they end up with two different momenta. So we have to destroy a particle destroy the initial particles and produce the final particle. So it's going to have two destruction operators, two creation operators. So it looked like there'll be an integral in time. Because there might be local in time. There'll be an integral d3 k1, and we're imagining there's a two-body interaction that two particles come in, two particles go out. So say we call that p1, p2, p3, and p4. So it'll involve four momenta, so we'll have p3, p1, p3, p2, p3, 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 p4. There'll be a momentum-conserving delta function somewhere, because we're normally looking at the momentum showing interactions, so we'll have number 3 of p1 plus p2 plus 4. So there'll be some amplitude, v, which will depend on the momentum, p1, p2, p4. And then we'll have the field dependence will be, we have to destroy two particles and create two particles, so there'll be a psi of p1, psi of p2, psi star of p3, For relativistic particles where you have a particle and antiparticle, a field destroys typically the particle and creates the antiparticle, but now we don't have any antiparticles. We have an old fashioned non-relativistic field theory. So this destroys the particle P1, destroys the particle this one at P2, those are the initial ones, and it creates one with P3 and creates one with P4. And you can have processes where you might imagine free body interaction, where you have, let's say, six powers of psi. It's going to be three psi pluses and three psi minuses. There's always the same number of psi pluses and psi minuses if the number of particles is conserved. So that's kind of what I'm building in here. That's more powers. And what I want to ask is, how do those things change as we do this rescaling? So the first thing is that if we're very near the Fermi surface, we can tailor expand everybody around the Fermi surface, and the first trip will be just to replace everybody here by Fermi momentum. So we can write V as V of P1, P2, P3, and P4, and possibly V of K1, K2, K3, K4, plus powers of L.
L1, L2, L3, L4.
And we can also take these measures, D3P, and write them as being DL1, D2K1. And it's clear that if we're asking for things, anything that survives, anything that goes to zero as S goes to zero is something which is small at low energies. And so, these things involving powers of L will be smaller than this term, because every power of L is scaling. You know, L goes to S times L. So this stuff is definitely going to be subatomic. So we can that's close to zero. So it's sufficient, I think, to start, because the case I'm going to make is that essentially nothing survives with kind of one interesting exception as S goes to zero. And so I just focus on these guys, and you shouldn't worry about the ones that are left, because they're just the smaller ones that are left. And a similar thing is true for these guys involving more powers of the size. You might have thought that more powers of the size are going to actually could be more important, because size scales like a negative power of S. And you might have thought that, so that means every time I add another psi star psi, I've added another one of S to the answer. But every time I do that, I have to integrate over their momenta. And so each new particle, so every time you have it, you add it, and D3P, D3P2, and psi star P1, psi P2. Those are the kind of things I'm adding when I add new interactions. I add also functions, where the functions I can always tailor expand and sit in the Fermi surface, and I don't get an extra penalty for having done that. But these guys, you know, how do these things scale? This is each one of these is a DL D2K. A1, O1. And so what we're getting is a factor of S from this, nothing from this, S from this, nothing from this, S to minus 1 half from this, and S to minus 1 half from this. You see that even though this gives you 1 over S, this gives you an S squared, so the whole thing goes like S. So all these more than two body interactions are going to also be less important at low energies than the one that I look at, so I'll work with them. And so if I had time derivatives, which is another thing I could have added, every dt was like S, and so that's also less important. So the ones that have a chance of being important at low energies are these ones that we're looking at, where we specialize to the Fermi surface. And so what I'm going to argue now is that for the most part, those are also going to zero when S goes to zero. What about these ones? So let's specialize now with these guys. And I'll just take K's here. And now we have to ask how things scale. And so to do that, obviously, I'll start with the right hand. So it's the test interaction in VT, DL1, D2K1, L2, so it looks simple, because we're going to get a factor of 1 over s here. We're going to get a factor of 1 over s for each of these l's. Then just talk about the seconds. We'll get nothing from here. We'll get an s and a minus 1 half for each of these fields. But the only thing that's subtle is this delta function. Because the delta function is going to do some of these integrals, right? And now it's important to know whether it's doing a k integral or an l integral. Because if it's doing a k integral, it doesn't take part in the scaling. But if you have to use a delta function, you have to use one of these L integrals to do the delta function, then what's happening is that the delta function scales inversely to the measure. And so some of the things you thought were appearing, we would have expected to get a factor of s for every L.
So then we'll get delta 3, right?
3, yeah. But if the delta function is doing some of the L integrals, then we're going to get less scaling than we thought. And so the only subtlety is to ask, does this momentum conserving delta function, is it involving only the k's, or does it also have to involve the l's? And so that's something which divides up the two cases. So what you're asking for that is you're asking, So we've got some Fermi surface, and you choose two initial states, P1 and P2, let's say. You're asking, are there two more momenta which can be written? You know, we're allowed to go to momenta which are whose sum equals this, these two sums. And so if I choose a P3 somewhere here on the Fermi surface, then P4 will be set by momentum conservation. Generically, what will happen is it will sit off the Fermi surface. Is the worry. If we take the locus of points that is allowed, that we're allowed to get for P3 and P4, we want to know, is that something which is necessarily cutting across the Fermi surface, or is that something which generically lives in the Fermi surface? And so the simplest one to think about is the sphere. So if you do the sphere, what's simple about the sphere is that the center mass, it's always useful to think of the center mass, because the center mass, you know, if you wrote, you know, P center mass, P1, P2, and you write all the momenta to be the center mass momentum plus P prime, okay, prime equals 1 to 4, then momentum conservation says that, you know, P1 prime plus P2 prime is 0, that's equal to P3 prime plus P4. So the center mass frame, the momenta are always back to back. And the nice thing about a sphere is that the origin is a center mass, so it's easy to think about. So suppose here's P1, here's P2. So what we're supposed to do is choose a P3. what's the statement? So if you take P1 plus P2 in this case, that's going to be a vector which points in that direction, right? And it typically generically won't lie in the thermal surface. Now we ask, what are the set of, we're asking, what are the final momenta whose sum could equal this? And we're in particular asking, could we choose, is there a restriction to being on the thermal surface for that? And you can kind of see that, in this particular case, if I take any pair of P's which are kind of located around that one, those live perfectly well on the thermal surface, and they have the same sum. So what that says is, let me make sure I say this right. So in this situation, I have a generic momentum here. I take the P3, which is also the thermal surface, but it comes out of the board, it's here. Then there will be a unique P4, which will be determined by the delta function, and it will automatically live on the thermal surface, which is the first one to get the thermal surface. And so that says that in that situation, this delta function is all K integrals. It's not any element integrals, because there wasn't an extra constraint to be on the thermal surface given that the first one was on the thermal surface. So the generic situation is so that center mass argument was actually red herring. It was there was a point of movement, which is didn't make sense. So if you get thrown off with the center mass, forget it. The situation is that in the delta 3, so if P1, P2, and P3 are all chosen on the thermal surface, then P4 equals P1 plus P2 minus P3 equals 2. So that means that all three parts of delta 3, P1 plus P2 minus P3 minus P4 are doing V3K integrals, not the elements. So in that case, there will be exceptions to that. Goes to S to some power times itself. And the power will be, we're going to get 1 over S for the DT. There'll be 4 S's for the D, 4 momentum intervals. Then we're going to get nothing from the delta function because that's a K delta function. Nothing from the DK intervals. Nothing from the V of K. Then we'll get an S to the minus a half 4 times for the size. So we'll have minus 4. So that's S to the 4 minus 2 minus 1 is 1. And so that does go to 0 as S goes to 0. So that shows you that these two body interactions generically are becoming less and less important at low energies. The more body interactions are even more suppressed, the time derivative interactions are more suppressed. The things that involve the interactions off the thermal surface are more suppressed. And that's showing you that most of the interactions are going away to the low energies. And that's the statement that so almost all interactions become less and less important. That low energy. Assuming you entered a regime where you could do this kind of turning of the powers of how things scale. So if we assume we were in a turbulent regime, the degrees of freedom that were important looked like weakly interacting fermions, you know, with network service, so there's some sort of charge going on to make them not equal numbers of size and size stars. Let's see, so there is a game where directions. So the assumption that you're in a weak interacting situation just gets better and better as you go with lower and lower energies. And so this is what so then in a metal, what would happen is that once you get down to you do conductivity measurements, that energy is much lower than the typical energy levels of the electrons and the atoms. So once you get down to those low energies, there are states that are not so far from Fermi surface, that are not so weakly interacting, and those quasi-particle states just get the description in terms of them in generic gets better and better. So it shouldn't be then surprising that the weakly interacting free particle model of conductors works pretty well, because it's neglecting these interactions, which are getting less and less important as you get to lower energies. And this is also it's what you it could be more systematic, and it's what would be called the Landau permutation. Because it more or less he makes the judgment in kind of a less formal way. And I should say this most of the time taken from Polchinski's classic lectures. Which I didn't tell you that I've read before. But TH 120046. And he kind of goes through and he does some calculations with this just to show you whether it's good for something. It's not just a state of the interaction, just small. You can say something about the interaction. So far, so good. So now the missing step is I told you that there were exceptions. And so what you're interested in are exceptions where this delta function, if this delta function actually did an L integral, then that would be exactly what you would, without changing everything, right? Because if the delta function did an L integral, you'd lose one of these power of S. So instead of going like S, it would have gone in 10 of S, and that would be the state that those interactions will be irrelevant importance, won't change as you go down to the low and low energy. And the answer is generically yes. So and the generic situation is if normally so if P1 equal to minus P2, so the sum is zero, then all that says is that the so I should say that, let me say it this way. If K element of Fermi surface implies that minus K is also an element of Fermi surface, then if P1 is equal to minus P2, Fermi surface, Well, what we know that P3 plus P4 has to be 0, 2. But we're not told that it has to sit in the Fermi space. Right? So if we thought in terms of a sphere, if we take the initial momenta, then this has the property that if I have one vector on the Fermi surface, its opposite is also on the Fermi surface. And that's something which is a general property if you have symmetry under P equals minus P, which I want to say parity. But, so parity if I take these two guys as the initial momentum, the thing is that the momentum conservation, so my story is that I'm told that I'm allowed to choose P3 arbitrarily, and then P4 will be the other guy. But I can satisfy this. The previous situation was that you can see that any pair of momenta, well, the P4 and P3 is going to satisfy this momentum conservation condition. Even if these guys, so the condition these guys lived on the Fermi surface isn't restricting these guys to live on the Fermi surface. And so that's the difference. I don't know if I'm beating the head or something here, but so the what's different between this and the previous situation was if we generically had something like this where we had a momentum here, a momentum here, so the sum was here. If I just start taking random vectors up in this direction that are not on the Fermi surface, then there's no choice for the only way to get something on the Fermi surface would be to choose something which is inside the Fermi surface, which is not allowed, because that's something which is probably blocked. So what was happening here was I was only allowed to choose this first guy to be on the Fermi surface in the first place just by the condition that it had to sum up to this vector here. And once I had that on, the second one was also on the Fermi surface. But I didn't have the freedom to choose these guys off the surface anyway. The fact that these two guys were on the surface was constraining the second two guys to be on the surface. Yeah. But here it's not.
Can't you do there then that you take one of them to go in the opposite direction of your resulting vector and use very large, and then the other one in the direction of your vector and then even larger, and then both on the Fermi surface as well? So the same thing you should do over there, but then with that as a resulting vector.
I want to say no. You're saying that the not in the large limit. You're saying it's a very large limit that I could get to. That's true. Then this is not saying there's no interactions ever. It's just saying there's no interactions with only unit. Because I'm supposed to be taking vectors that are remember, everybody has to live within some scale lambda of the Fermi surface. And so the rules were that these vectors I'm choosing had to sum up to the P3 equals P4 have to sum up to P1 plus P2, and all four of them should live in the strip around the Fermi surface.
So this way you're drawing over there is not actually allowed with the
around like this. But you see that the point I'm making is true, and then we have a true there. So that there is true. So in this case, what happens is that one of the integrals, one of the delta functions is doing the L integral. So the thing that actually nails you to the Fermi surface here will then put you over here. So the DL, so delta sum of momenta is exactly one. So if we now do the same story as we did before, then S. It used to be minus 1 plus 4, but now it's plus 3 because there's one of the integrals that under the delta function. You have minus 4. So this is what's called a marginal interaction. So it's relative strength compared to the unperturbed thing is not changing as you go to lower and lower energies. Whereas this is what you would have called an irrelevant interaction. So since this is a was irrelevant in the renormalization group sense. And if something had been going like, so if we had found S interaction goes like S to the minus something, K positive, that would have been called a relevant interaction. And so the story here is that generically interactions are all irrelevant in the infrared and the long distance limit, so we'll already know it. But some specific interactions are marginal at the level we've calculated things. There's other situations where you can get, even have this kinematics happen, such as if you have this kind of generic situation, which is where will you even. You can have an interaction survive. So another situation that needn't happen, but which could happen, where supposing you have the ferrous surface has a plane part to it. Right. This ferrous surface. So let's suppose that the ferrous surface has one side to it, which is a translation on the other side. So there's a fixed end which translates to the other side. And this kind of thing happens when sometimes you have these cubic ferrous surfaces.
Yeah,
for
the diagonal
shape.
Oh,
they're right. In this situation, it's also true that if you choose two guys to be P1 and P2, let me see that now. So that what we're saying is that if K is equal to zero, that implies that epsilon of k plus n. So the story for this momentum conservation would be so we choose p1 and p2 to be on the ferrous surface, then we can for free by shifting it to the so we shift p1 and p2 to here, let's say. So we'll choose P1 to be, P2 to be P1 plus N. So now I take P3. So now if I take a momentum that's near P1, that it goes off the ferrous surface, you can see that I can get something to work if I've done this right.
Probably mean minus P1 plus N.
I'm going to be asking for P3 for people with M. So I'll probably the next thing what I want to do is get two vectors in like this. T3, I should have wrote by hand. So T3 would be one, and T4 would be two. So. Yeah, then what's happening on the guest program? So I think what I'm trying to say is that I have a take two on one side. Then that, but if I take the energy of each, so E of P3 is for free equal to the energy of P1, so that's on the planar surface because of the shift property. And what I want to show is that I can return off the planar surface and preserve the kinematics. So if I displace a little bit off the planar surface, I keep this thing being true, then I'm guaranteed that I'm going to be just off the surface on the other side. And so that means that I have to, that makes it like this situation, that it, in the situation, a sphere that I've drawn here, I'll erase it somewhat, I guess. You know, the thing with the sphere, when I had the two vectors like this, was that I couldn't choose. Choosing a vector above the surface was killing me because I was forced to go under the surface on the other side. And so I really was always forced to live on the surface if I wanted to satisfy the energy condition. And what was special here was that I had the liberty of going off the surface on both sides and still satisfying energy more conservation. And that's what's happening here too. Because if I shift off the surface here, I've raised energy a little bit, but I'm guaranteed that if because I've got these things related by an N, that what I want to say is that I'm going to be off the positive side of the surface because I raised the energy when I'm close to the surface because of this fact that the planar surface was invariant of the shift. And I might be garbling that argument, but the statement is true. That in these special situations where you have a special shape of the planar surface, it can be true that you do one of the intervals over L. You do with the delta function, and so the statement from those interactions is just like for this one here, where the momenta are opposite. But this one is more generic in the sense that all you really want here is that the very surface was, if k was on the very surface, minus k was also on the very surface, which is all introduced because it's more generic. So the thing that is showing me here, I have to reboot on this. In all cases, what's going to happen is that these so if it's a marginal interaction, if these interactions are marginal, they're not less important than the energies. But that doesn't mean they're going to get more important either. And so the claim is, the missing step, which I'm not going to come to, is because so that the contact directions to a scale. That arise in perturbation theory. So far everything I've described was just I took the interaction and I scaled everything, but I didn't actually calculate the effects of perturbations in that scaling. In and these interactions which are weak. And in particular, if they can change the sign, because if we're starting at zero, the correction will either go up or go down. Because this is marginal corrections to its skin and rise per reason theory that dominate. Because you're competing with zero, whatever you get dominates. So if you include those corrections, so in general what will happen is S will go to S to the P, where P, absolute value, is much, much less than 1, perturbation theory. And this would be the anomalous dimension. Which I'm not telling you how to calculate, because we're also just, if you go up there and see if you have calculated, then unfortunately you calculate it, because the main tip here, I shouldn't use P, let's call it Q, let's call it delta. When the delta is positive, then S, then this is going to go to zero. It just goes to zero slower than you thought. And so this is sometimes called, it's marginally irrelevant. So then S goes to zero. So it's irrelevant, but it's only marginally irrelevant because it was originally marginal, and then perturbation theory is tipped over the edge, perturbation theory is tipped over the edge. And delta is less than zero, S interaction goes to infinity. That would be marginally relevant. And the claim is that a two-body interaction like we've been talking about will typically take this interaction, an interaction like this, and it makes it marginally relevant. So this you should take a look at closer. The notes are the notes in your handout, which are based on this. So, perturbation theory. Using the two body interactions we've been talking about. Zero if the interaction K1, Kn, K4 is so this is the margin of error in case that's positive repulsive interaction. And then given less than zero. So that says that if you have an interaction somewhere else in the problem which is feeble but attractive, then it's going to take this particular interaction which has a momenta directed oppositely, and what it'll do is it'll amplify it at low energy because it's marginally relevant. So feeble, attractive interactions act to enhance the hearing direction. That relates state of momentum P to state of momentum minus P, for example, or states that are related in the way that you have over a nested Fermi surface. And so in a superconductor, what happens is that pairing interaction eventually becomes strong. It gets strong at some place which is exponentially small because this thing is going to be, whenever you have a scaling which is S to a very, very small power, if you ask what's the energy where this becomes important, it's when this running is basically logarithmic. The energy will happen at some exponentially small place. And that's the explanation for this. When you calculate the BCS critical temperature in terms of the bifrequency of the various scales that are in the physics of the kinetic matter system, the typical VCS transition temperatures are low because this interaction takes a while to become important, because it started off as a weak interaction and it had to run through quite a long distance to become dominant. But once it becomes dominant, it binds the Cooper pair, and that's what makes a superconductor for you. So it's a very pretty picture for this kind of argument, is showing you that if you ask how accurate should that picture be, if you didn't make this argument, then you would have thought, well, it's got to be a really crappy argument, because you're keeping some very feeble interaction, you're throwing away the Coulomb interaction, and so you, you're lucky to get factors, be right with factors of 2 or 10. But if the critical temperatures you get this way are, they work to the 10% kind of argument. So, and that's because what's controlling the argument is really powers of energy, not powers of coupling, because you're guaranteed that all these other interactions, the Coulomb interaction included, are generically not important because the low energies are being suppressed. The Coulomb interaction for the paired guy starts off, what counts is whether that or the, that or the attractive interaction dominates, and then the Coulomb interaction plays a role in how long you have to run before the change from before the interaction, the pairing interaction becomes important. But it's not invalidating the calculation because this one interaction is dominating the lower. So it's a very attractive picture as to how to understand something which is an kinetic matter business that we took all along. What's controlling the approximation is the Pauli blocking of a low energy approximation, given that these things are degenerate. But it's a very nice quantitative way to make that easy to understand for non-practitioners. So that's a really good place to stop. So unless there's any questions, any questions on that? This is the last chance for questions for me. It's an email, you're welcome to email it. The notes, I looked at the notes more carefully, and what slowed me down saying to you was that part one is actually crap, because I can see that I went part two and I didn't finish it. So I'll send you the part two, which is what has this thing in it. And then I'll send you the reason I didn't finish part one in this iteration is that it eventually became one of the articles, so I'll send you a copy of the review article. There's one of the ones I started already. So this is the one thing you don't have in the reference I gave you is this part two, which I'll call some of the PDF for. And the assignment is due January 4th or earlier. But the burden is on you. It's a hard deadline because the marks have to be eliminated, and you need to get to me electronically, and don't just get it to the conservator building, because it's probably true I won't be here on January 4th or December 23rd, if I won't be here either. So if you do it in the next couple of days, I'll be here, but don't rely on me being here to pick it up. It's true that they'll get encouraged over to me if it's not fine, but it's better for you just to find these guys. So it is a problem with that coming out to minimum arrangement, but that's what the default should be. Okay. Okay.
I'm good.
And the pain.